Are you driven to solve the problems of society? Do you want to make a difference either in the private, public, or not-for-profit sphere? Would you love to be surrounded by brilliant people? Then Harvard Kennedy School is probably on your list of target programs. Listen to this podcast to learn from its admissions director how you can get in. Hello and welcome. Thanks for joining me for this week's 320th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in," not only in, but in the best program for you. The featured resource for today's show is Fitting In and Standing Out, the Paradox at the Heart of Admissions. Your application needs to show that you will do both, and that's the difficult paradox central to getting accepted. Master that paradox, and you are well on your way to acceptance. Download this free guide at accepted.com/FISO. Again, that's accepted.com/FISO for Fitting In and Standing Out. It's been almost 3 years since we last had on Admissions Straight Talk Matt Clemens, Director of Admissions at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Matt entered the admissions field at Manhattan School of Music and subsequently served for 5 years as Director of Admissions and Financial Aid at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. He joined Harvard Kennedy School in 2011 as Director of Admissions and has been there for the last roughly 8 years. Listener, you'll find some overlap between this podcast and that of 3 years ago, but I'm sure there's been a lot of change and a lot of new material that we're going to cover today. You can find that podcast at accepted.com/167. Matt, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Glad to be here.
Great. Now, for those not familiar with it, and for those who haven't listened to 167, can you give us an overview of the MPP program, the Master's in Public Policy? What is the MPP at Harvard Kennedy School?
So the MPP can be framed, I guess, against MBA and JD programs in the sense that those degrees are teaching you to engage in professional issues. They're professionally oriented programs. And the MPP is very much the same. We're teaching a skill set to help people solve problems. We're not a traditionally academic focused program that is concerned with theory and research. It's more on teaching people skills to solve problems. A lot of the skills are very similar to what someone would learn in a business school program: negotiation, management, leadership, quantitative analysis, persuasion, communication, those sorts of things. But the case studies, the internships, the types of work that students will engage in will be focused more on how public policy is impacting people's lives, whether that is public policy that's being influenced by work in the private sector or through the not-for-profit or through traditional government channels. Our graduates go into all three fields.
Okay. Now, the MPP, as I understand it, is your largest program. Is that correct?
Correct.
And how does it differ from the Master's of Public Administration and the Master's of Public Administration International Development?
Sure. So one of the things that policy schools like us did not do, probably to our detriment, similar to what law and business have done, is come up with one acronym that is used across the industry. We have MPP degrees, MPA degrees, and whatnot. I don't want people to get confused by the acronyms across the different programs, but at the Kennedy School specifically, the Master of Public Administration and International Development kind of takes quantitative analysis to a deeper level and focuses on how developing economies can be managed in a way to integrate them into the global economy. So a lot of people will go on to work, graduates of the program, for multilateral organizations like the IFC, the World Bank, the IMF, or perhaps the Ministry of Finance for their individual country. 75% of the people in the MPID program are from outside of the United States, and the program was constructed with that in mind. And so while you could study international development in the MPP program, the MPID program is going to take a uniquely rigorous quantitative lens. And the first year of the program is almost equivalent to what a PhD in economics would give a student.
So it sounds like it's very quantitative.
It is, but it always transitions back to the practical implementation of policy on the ground rather than getting stuck in the theoretical weeds, so to speak.
And the MPA without the ID?
The MPA at the Kennedy School, the two-year program, is mm-hmm. for people who have either already been to graduate school or right. they are admitted to a partner school. And we have partner schools within the university here and also outside as well.
In terms of jobs for the MPA, is it the same diversity of opportunity as in the MPP, or is it, again, more governmentally oriented or more NGO oriented?
Well, the MPA two-year program, a lot of students in that program are pursuing a concurrent or dual business degree. Mm-hmm. And so many of them end up pursuing careers in the private sector because their motivation in going to business and a policy school is to figure out how businesses can make positive contributions to society and help influence in policy in a particular way. So I would say that all programs give people the ability to go into the public, private, or not-for-profit sectors, but certainly those in the two-year MPA program, since so many of them have either already been in a business or econ program or are concurrently pursuing a program with a business school, are inclined to go to the private sector.
Okay. All right. What is the Mason program or cohort in the mid-career MBA? MPA.
So the mid-career program, it's a one-year program, and the mid-career is for individuals from developed economies, and the Mason part of it is for people from transitional okay. or developing economies. So there's really no difference in the curriculum. The only difference between the two programs is that the Mason candidates come and spend an extra 2 weeks on campus before everyone else arrives. For many of them, they may not have studied in an environment like they'll experience here, and we want to give them a little boot camp. But as far as the application process, the only difference is citizenship.
Okay. All right. And I was looking at the site before the call, and you have joint programs, concurrent programs, dual degree programs, and HKS offers all three. Again, what is the difference between those three kinds of programs that the Kennedy School offers along with something else?
Sure. So the joint degree programs are only within Harvard. We have a joint program with the Harvard Business School. We have a joint program with the Harvard Law School. And joint means that faculty from the two schools have gotten together and they have said, we want students to engage in a particular set of courses or have to fulfill a certain set of requirements. In the case of the business school, there's actually a particular order that they want them to complete. They have to start year one at the Kennedy School, year two at the business school, and then they split the last year between the two. And so joint basically means within Harvard and faculty have come to some sort of agreement. Concurrent and dual, actually, there's no difference. We may use the terminology on the website, but it basically means more of a flexible, less organized. For example, MIT Sloan is right down the street, and you know Rod Garcia and his team are going to make decisions on who gets admitted, and my team and I are going to do that as well. And if they get into both programs, they could determine where they would like to start. They could start at MIT. They could start here. There's no particular set of courses that the faculty at the two schools have come together to agree on. Each school will work with the other in some regard to count credits from the other school toward the credits so they can graduate in a year less time than it would take to do separately. But basically, you can look at the dual and the concurrent programs as taking place outside of Harvard.
And in all three cases, the time required is a little bit shorter, right?
Yes. The joint, concurrent, dual programs all require 1 year less of enrollment. And so if you were a JD student, the typical pathway would be 3 years. If you're at the Kennedy School, 2 years. So that would be five if you do them separately. But if you combine them, it's four. And with business, it would be four, but you reduce the length to three.
Okay. And the last question I have in terms of admissions to the joint or dual or concurrent or whatever you want to call them programs, in all cases, does the applicant have to get accepted to each individual program? Or even with the joint, is there some kind of joint admissions process?
There is no joint or concurrent admissions process. So an applicant who is interested in the different programs is going to have to apply to each school separately. And if they get an admission offer from the two different schools, they can then notify us. So another example, let's say someone applies to Stanford GSB and they're admitted and they apply to the Kennedy School, they would then inform the admissions directors at each school that they've been admitted to both and they want to pursue the concurrent degree. And we would work with them on what we call our flight plan, you know, how they're going to go through the program. Most of the business school applicants have two options. It's either a 1-1 split or a 1-split-1, meaning 1 year at one school, 1 year at the other, and then splitting the last year, or 1 year at one school, splitting the middle year, and then spending the final year at one of the programs. The only thing they can't do is complete the entirety of one program and then the other. The reason for the 1-split-1 for some people is they want to return to the school they started at and walk with the class they started with. Technically, they won't earn their degree because they have to complete the two programs before that's granted, but they may want to walk across the stage with those they started the program with.
Right. And if you are accepted to one, let's say you apply to the joint HBS-HKS program. Let's say you're only accepted to HKS. Can you still attend HKS, or is it all or nothing?
Oh, it's certainly a situation where each individual's school's admissions decision stands. So if Chad Losey and his team over at HBS determine that they're not going to be able to offer admission to a candidate, but we are, the student is more than welcome to start at the Kennedy School. Chad and the admissions committee across the river are going to do their thing and make decisions that are best for the business school. And we're going to make decisions over here that are best for the Kennedy School. Well, we do, both of the schools ask, and anytime someone is applying to a joint, dual, or concurrent program, there is an essay prompt on the application, which asks basically for their motivation in doing so. But it's not a critical factor in our evaluation. I don't call Chad or Rod or people at the other schools and say, hey, what are you thinking about this candidate? The processes are completely separate. I know that the business school has two rounds and they make their decisions. Christy Jobson is the director at the Harvard Law School and they do rolling admission and they're making their own decisions. So it very much is independent. And if someone is not admitted to one program and admitted to the other, they could still reapply in all cases, really, except for the business school, the Harvard Business School. So if somebody were admitted to MIT Sloan and applied to the Kennedy School and did not get in, when they're at year one at MIT, they could actually reapply for admission to the Kennedy School if they like.
Okay, great. That's good to know. Now, approximately what percentage of students take advantage of the dual degree programs at HKS?
Of our two-year students, it's about 20%. So it's a very healthy percentage.
Yeah. All right. Now, it has been about 3 years since we spoke. What's new in the last 3 years at Harvard Kennedy School?
So I would say there's a very strong emphasis on social innovation. We actually started a new social innovation lab, and we now have a fellowship program that will fund students who want to start their own enterprises. So it's not traditional financial aid that one would use towards tuition or living expenses. It's actually funding to help them get their enterprise going. And they also receive assistance from faculty and from alumni and from other innovators that the Kennedy School is connected to. And so social innovation is a huge thing. Also, digital HKS is our foray into ensuring that we try to make sure that policymakers are up to date with what's going on as much as possible with technology and trying to keep up. Business obviously is out there to disrupt, and the government typically is playing catch up. And so we're doing a lot to hire new faculty and also try to attract students with backgrounds in technology and engineering and computer science to come and think about the interface between policy and technology. One of the big areas that we're focused on now, for example, is autonomous vehicle policy, where you definitely need people with an understanding of computer science and engineering and whatnot, and also the implications of what autonomous vehicles on the road are actually going to mean for society, and that's a very complex issue. So innovation and technology in general are two things that we've been putting a lot of resources and time into.
Can you give us an example of something that perhaps either a student or a grad is working on in that arena?
Yeah, so a couple of our students a few years ago started something called TurboVote, which was trying to address the issue of when people are separated from their locale. Let's say they grew up in Los Angeles and now they're going to school in Boston. It may be very difficult to sign up to vote or logistically not possible, and they wanted to address that through using technology to make it easier to register to vote. Another example in recent, actually I can say a current student is involved, and one of the things I like to emphasize is that we tell our students not to wait until they graduate to engage with the world, but actually to start doing it while they're with us. And a lot of that either takes the form of a pro bono consulting project, or they can start their own project while they're here. In this case, George Clement started a program called Just Fix NYC. It's actually an app that people in New York City can use to report issues with their landlords and neglected living conditions. And so he'd already started the app before he came to the Kennedy School and was having success, but he came here to really give it a turbo boost. And now he's looking to take the program to other cities around the United States. He entered Just Fix NYC into the President's Innovation Competition. The president of Harvard University gives away roughly $500,000 to Wow. students every year who want to solve sticky public problems. And George entered into the competition and actually got a check for $75,000 to help expand his already successful enterprise. So yeah, basically using apps and technology to make voting easier or to make it possible for people who are facing sticky conditions to make sure that their voices are heard.
All right, great. What are you looking for in applicants across all your degree programs?
Well, when I'm talking to applicants, I tell them simply there's really two questions that the admissions committee is seeking to answer. It's really no more complicated than number one, can you learn what we teach? And everyone is going to have to engage with quantitative methods. So we're going to want to know that people have some fluency in numbers. Obviously, there's lots of reading. You need to be able to get your ideas across in a concise way. So writing skills are important. But we're not predominantly focused on GPA and test scores in the sense of we're looking for people who are academics. So the question of can someone learn what we teach is both through their academic and professional background, have they proven that we think they can learn? And second is, do they fit the DNA of what a Kennedy School student is about? And we'd like to think that that's leadership and service. And so throughout an application, we're going to be looking for people who have engaged in ways to develop their leadership skills and have sought to serve causes greater than their own development. We certainly expect people to do well for themselves academically and professionally, but we're also looking for people who've been involved in helping others in some way, if it's being involved in an election or being a mentor or spending time at a not-for-profit. Anything that kind of shows a dedication to community or policy issues or region, something like that, gets us really excited.
What about the career changer? Let's say an investment banker has been, you know, working grueling hours and says he wants to go more into a social innovation track. Mm-hmm. Are you still going to, how would you address that individual? What advice would you have for that kind of person?
Well, it would really be the same type of advice, saying you can be very successful in your career and you have a transferable skill set. And so you've been working in investment banking, let's say, and earning money for other people who maybe already have money. And we had an applicant a few years ago who's telling a story just like that, saying, I've basically been spending my career helping people with money get more money, and I now want to take those skills and transfer them to the sector where people don't have a lot of money or need help with investments, and I want to develop a not-for-profit that focuses on that. We had another student who had a career in consulting and in marketing, and she came to the Kennedy School because she wanted to transition to the public sector. And having worked for a consulting firm before coming, she talked about the skills that were transferable, and her internship ended up being with the mayor's office here in Boston, and she started a City Hall to Go program where she transformed a police van into a mobile government office and started engaging with citizens where they live rather than making people come to the government to engage. And so we're looking for people who are creative, who are looking to deploy their skills in new ways. But there definitely would be an advantage for someone who not only says that, but is also backing that with involvement, and that can be displayed in the resume and through letters of recommendation.
Okay. All right, great. Now, it also seems like there's some difference in terms of the experience and education requirements. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, earlier when we were talking about the differences between the MPP and the MPA, and then the mid-career obviously is very, very different in terms of the experience requirements. But what kind of experience, let's say, in academics are you expecting? Obviously, there's a focus on service. That's clearly a differentiating factor for the Harvard Kennedy School. But in terms of, again, academic background, years of work experience, kinds of work experience, what are you looking for?
Well, the work experience doesn't really make a determination like a dispositive yes or no. It's more the story, like I was saying, about what they tell about their work experience. When it comes to academic background, we're going to look at three different things. We're going to look at their academic performance, obviously, their test score performance, and also their professional development and professional skills. So you could have someone, for example, who maybe didn't take a lot of math or econ in college, but scores exceptionally well on the quantitative section of the GRE or the GMAT, and will accept either. And again, the question for us is, can they learn what we teach, not are they a brilliant academic? And you could have someone, on the other hand, who did very well in undergrad and maybe in a quantitatively heavy major, but didn't maybe perform well on the GRE or GMAT, and we would be confident maybe through the grades and a letter of recommendation from maybe a faculty member that they could engage and do really well here. So it's always kind of the story. You know, all the different pieces of the application are puzzle pieces, and we're looking to put together those pieces to ensure that people can learn what we teach and do have that commitment to service. But there's no one list of classes. It's very typical for us to see, obviously, statistics, mathematics, and economics. But there's people from other majors who've taken classes in maybe the hard sciences or in engineering or computer science or something like that, who are also able to demonstrate quantitative fluency.
Or if they come from the humanities, as long as they have the quantitative background, again, that's okay.
Yeah, you could have studied philosophy or psychology, sociology.
Or English lit or whatever.
Or English lit, yeah. I tell people it's A to Z, basically, here. You could name any major between anthropology and zoology, and you're going to find a Kennedy School grad who's probably studied that. I was actually just in Washington, D.C. last week and was approached by an applicant who is interested in the arts and was wondering if she could find a home at the Kennedy School. And we've had people who've worked for ballet companies, people who've worked for museums, who come to the Kennedy School because they believe that art and dance and music play a critical role in our society, and they want to seek ways to either run a not-for-profit or manage a museum or to expose people to the arts. And so anyone with any background, as long as they have a compelling story and we believe they can learn what we teach, are gonna receive serious consideration for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Now, when you're reviewing an application, I assume that there are many, many more applications that you receive where you see that there's this commitment to service, you see that they can learn what you teach. What differentiates, what gets you excited about an applicant?
I'd say that more than anything else, it's leadership development probably would make a candidate stand out, someone who has really taken initiative, maybe taken some risks, who is creative and really put them in a place that challenges themselves in a way that's going to help them develop skills. And really, we're looking at applicants in two other areas. One is we're looking for what they're going to be able to contribute to the program. So we want people who are going to, we do a lot of group work, and they're going to be involved in that conversation, and they're going to be contributing to the learning environment. And two, we're looking for them to be good consumers while they're here. And the more work experience you have, the more exposure you have, typically the more quickly you're going to identify extracurricular activities, courses, faculty, pro bono consulting projects that are going to align with your long-term career ambitions and put you in a better place to kind of catch on quickly, because it's a very quick program. One of the complaints of alumni is, oh, it just went by so fast. And we really feel like we want people to hit the ground running while they're here. And so if they've already been engaged in leadership development and they've been a little bit creative and engaged in different issues, it'll put them in a good place here because they're going to have a lot thrown at them.
Right, right. Okay. What's a turnoff in an application?
Wow. I would say maybe the word contrived, or one of the things I do is I do run an admissions blog, and I try to give
an excellent admissions blog, by the way. We are going to link to it from the show notes. It's definitely a must read if you're applying to Harvard Kennedy School.
So I guess one example would be if something in an essay sounds like something that would be taken from our website, you should take it out. The admissions committee members are very familiar with the Kennedy School. We work here and we get paid to work here. So we know everything about the Kennedy School. What we're looking for is information about the applicant and how their passion and previous background and desires are going to translate into good things happening in the world. So I would say that being trite, being, you know, repeating things that we probably already are very familiar with, we're looking to get to know the applicant. I know it sounds really basic, but it's amazing how many times you can take almost an entire paragraph from one of the essays and it reads like something that would be on our website. Another pet peeve is people who quote people in their essays. Again, your goal is to get your own thoughts and your own words across to us. It's not to parrot what someone else has said.
Even Kennedy?
Even Kennedy. And people do point out the irony that one of our essay questions for the MPP program is basically in the spirit of John F. Kennedy's quote, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. You know, kind of give us your motivation in attending the program. But in this sense, we're using the quote to get something out of you. We're not using the quote in a sense that we would want an applicant to, which would basically just be to repeat what someone has already said.
Right, right. Yeah, I can hear that. I frequently say that the applications are there to introduce the applicant. They want to meet you. They don't want to meet somebody else.
True, very true.
Right. Now, your essays for this year are not out yet. Any plans to change them?
No, there's really no plans to change them. The admissions committees have been meeting, and we won't be changing any of the essays. We will be adding a biographical prompt for MPP applicants. We experimented last year with our MPA applicants, and really what it is a lot of our applicants, especially to the mid-career program, come in with decades of experience. And when you just jump right into their resume, sometimes it's very jarring when you're going, maybe somebody has been working in investment banking and the next one you're reading is as a human rights activist, for example, and you're diving into the organizations and the acronym soup that sometimes exists. And so we added a little biographical essay, you know, summarizing your professional development, and the admissions committee really liked it. And we proposed adding a version of it to the MPP program. So it's not going to be anything that's deeply psychological or going to involve any trickery. It's just an opportunity for someone to kind of introduce their professional trajectory before we see their resume. So when we're reading the application, we would see that biographical statement before the resume.
A little bit of context there.
Correct. Yeah.
Now, HKS requires 3 recommendations. Most master's programs require 2. What is HKS looking for in the recommendations, and any reason for wanting 3 as opposed to 2 or 1 or whatever?
Well, I typically tell applicants that we're looking for a 360-degree view of someone in the letters of recommendation. So what is recommender A going to say about you that's unique and different than recommenders B and C? And B to A and C and C to A and B. And so there will be overlapping themes. Probably you're a good leader, you complete projects on time, you're responsible, and that sort of thing. But we really encourage people to think about what each recommender is going to say and how that's going to differ. And I will tell people that obviously the two categories of recommendation letter that people often think of are academic and professional. But if someone wanted to seek out a letter of recommendation for some work that they've been engaged in with a not-for-profit agency, or maybe they volunteered on a campaign or something like that, they could also do that. It doesn't need to be a letter of recommendation that relates to someone who has graded you or is doing your performance review or something like that. So I wouldn't say there's any magic to it. I actually inherited three letters of recommendation when I started here.
Uh-huh.
And the admissions committee has not advocated for any change. They feel like it is very useful to have those different perspectives. So no one has stepped forward and said, hey, we need to cut down the number. And so I think it's going to continue to be three.
Okay, great. Now, your brochure says that the interviews at Harvard Kennedy are not required, but that the admissions committee may contact applicants on a case-by-case basis. When would you contact an applicant? Would that contact become an interview, or would it be more like asking for clarification about something in the application?
It could either be clarification. I'd say the most common instance is actually English language ability. And so we may have a candidate who does not speak English as a native language, and we are really excited about their candidacy, but there may be something in their application that is a red flag. Maybe they took a lot of English classes in college, but their TOEFL score, one of the sections was very low, and it seems off. And oftentimes with the TOEFL, there's complaints about the microphones or the equipment that is being used, and we may want to clarify. There is an optional essay in the application where someone could say, I was having problems with the microphone. There was an instance a few years ago where there was a security concern going on. There was an emergency alert during the TOEFL exam that impacted someone's performance. And we felt overall the letters of recommendation all said that this person was able to operate in English just fine. They had taken English classes in college and done very well, but their TOEFL score was not what we were looking for. And just to confirm, you know, we may end up calling and asking a few questions, maybe having them respond to a writing challenge, give them something that they have to email within a certain amount of time, something like that. So that would probably be the most common reason.
Okay. Now, if somebody is planning to apply to this application cycle, right? I guess the deadline would be December 2019, right?
Correct.
Right. What advice would you have for them at this point in time? You just said that the essay questions are going to be basically the same. What advice would you have for them?
Well, going back to what I said earlier, I'd say following the admissions blog is a good piece of advice. We have student stories, we have alumni stories, we have application advice. One of the things I do annually is I review previous applications and I blog about the things that are impressive and maybe the things that are not so impressive. I don't think there'd be any magic. Visiting campus would be great. We do have open houses in the fall. We also have virtual information sessions. We understand that for some it can be difficult and expensive to travel, and so attending a virtual information session would be a way. If you are in Boston, we do have weekly information sessions on campus that people could attend. So I wouldn't say there's any mystical thing I could tell someone that's going to make them a better applicant, other than to take advantage of all of the resources that we provide, whether it's through the blog or virtual sessions or on campus sessions. We also lead sessions around the US and around the globe. And so if somebody is in Tokyo or Singapore or Mumbai, there could be an opportunity to meet students or alumni, or there may be staff who are traveling, and we put all of that information on the admissions blog to make it easily accessible.
And again, the blog is outstanding, and we're going to link to it from the show notes at accepta.com/320. What would you have liked me to ask you, Matt?
What would I have liked you to ask me?
Yeah.
I guess the big question that most applicants have that you didn't ask about was money.
Okay. Go for it.
Yeah, we do have a pretty sizable financial aid budget. We gave away around $27 million this year. So
sizable.
I tell people, don't be scared by the price. The sticker price can definitely be intimidating. Over half of the students attending the Kennedy School are receiving some form of funding from us. Another healthy chunk of people are receiving sponsorship. For example, one of our students who was doing the concurrent program between Stanford GSB and Kennedy was being fully sponsored by a consulting firm. So all of the costs for all 3 years were basically being borne by the consulting firm.
Wow.
Obviously, there was an agreement that this candidate would return back to the consulting firm, so they would get their money's worth. But don't let cost scare you. The application for admission is submitted by an applicant, and a little algorithm runs. And once you've done that, you get a financial aid application email sent off. Applicants have about 2 months to fill out the financial aid application. There are some fellowships that are tied to specific policy areas or interest areas or something about the applicant. And there may be specific essays or things that applicants will need to submit. So I would say that don't let cost scare you away from considering the Kennedy School. There are resources out there. We do have a loan forgiveness program as well. So we try to recognize the fact that some of the careers people are seeking when they leave the Kennedy School are not the most well compensated, and we want to make it possible for them to come here and get the education they seek, regardless of the financial scare factor, so to speak.
Right, right. Well, that was a very good question, so thank you for including it. I should have. And one thing I did remember is the Mason program, a funded program, the Mason cohort.
There is a lot of funding for Mason candidates. None of the programs that we offer are 100% funded, although we would love to be in that position one day. Mason candidates, like other programs, we're able to fund a percentage of the class, but certainly not the entirety of the class.
Okay. Well, Matt, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Where can listeners and potential applicants learn more about the Harvard Kennedy School's programs?
Well, to beat a dead horse, the admissions blog is great. We also have a Twitter account. It's honestly not as active as or useful as the admissions blog, because the admissions blog is a little bit more long form. Obviously, our website is a great way to catch up with news that's coming out of the school, whether it's faculty research or faculty engagement, what alumni are doing, what students are doing. There's a lot of stories on there, and sometimes we will also repost those stories on the admissions blog. But yeah, just the traditional channels that people would think about would be what I would recommend.
Wonderful. Thank you. All right. So we're going to include links in the show notes at exhibit.com/320, both to the Harvard Kennedy School website and to the blog that Matt has mentioned a few times. It's definitely not a dead horse at all. It's an excellent blog. And I think if you have any thought of applying to the Harvard Kennedy School, you really have to review the material presented both on the website itself, but even more so on the blog that Matt mentioned. Listener, thank you too for joining Matt Clemens and me for our 320th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please tell your friends about the useful, informative podcast that you're listening to. I thank you, and so will your friends. A quick reminder, master the paradox at the heart of graduate admissions by downloading our free guide, Fitting In and Standing Out, The Paradox at the Heart of Admissions. You can get your copy at exhibit.com/FISO for Fitting In, Standing Out. Thanks again for coming. This is Admissions Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.